outlook wasn't brilliant for the Mudville nine that day. The score stood 4-2 with but one inning more to play. And so when Cooney died at first and Burrows did the same, a sickly silence fell upon the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go in deep despair. The rest clung to that hope which brings eternal...
That is a DeWolf Hopper from about 109 years ago, 1909 recording of Casey at the Bat. Hopper made quite a career of presenting that in live performances through the years, but the poem itself, celebrating a birthday, 130 years old. And to talk about that and more, we're joined by our friend, writer and critic, Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
How's it going?
Very well, thank you. It looks like you're feeling better enough to take on the monument, huh?
Yeah, building back up to Zulu warrior status, but I'm able to do it a little bit right now.
I'm glad to hear that. So is it safe to say that Casey at the Bat is the most famous sports-related poem of all time?
Yes, I think it definitely is. Most famous and best. Now, if you're just hearing the version there by our Mr. Hopper, he's really going quite over the top with it, isn't he? Do you hear how he rolls those R's? It reminds me of that opening scene in James Whale's Bride of Frankenstein, right, where you have Lord Byron. He's doing like that cod, extra excessive British accent, and he's rolling those R's. And yes, that is what DeWolf Hopper would do, but a very popular poem, a poem so popular that even if you have never sat down to read it, you have encountered it many, many, many times in your life, even if you did not wish to.
Lots of speculation of the role model for Casey. Ernest Lawrence Thayer never really specified anybody, but everyone from a college player that he knew to King Kelly and others. What's your best guess?
King Kelly is definitely my best guess. He would have been like, you have to realize that baseball was basically like the only sport really going in America at this time. We're talking the late 19th century here. And so King Kelly was like Michael Jordan, right? But there was no competing sports leagues, basically. Like, you might have been into polo or hunting, but in terms of like team-based sports, it's pretty much going to be baseball. And King Kelly was huge. And the idea of him fanning, as it were, which is what, of course, happens with Casey in Mudville, would have been something that was highly provocative. And Thayer, he was like 24 years old at the time, and he thought this was just a piece of doggerel he was dashing off, and yet it has lingered in our consciousness, I think, because it taps into what is most centrally important about sports, and that's in caring a lot about something and rooting for something and not getting it. You're going to lose oftentimes in sports, no matter how great you are. And I think that's the poem's great lesson.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's lasted so long. If Casey hits a home run, I'm not sure we remember it 130 years later.
There are doctored versions you'll see, right? Like animated versions, film versions and stuff like that, where they have Casey do a walk-off. It's like, no, that doesn't work. And it's great because it really brings us in as the audience into the poem, because it makes such a focal point of bringing in the audience, the crowd, in the actual stands of the poem. Because basically, here's the setup for people who don't know it. It's presumably the bottom of the ninth. This is the home team, and they are trailing by two, and their first two batters record quick outs. These were kind of the guys that you thought were going to get on. So they're sort of like your Mookie Betts and your Andrew Benintendis, rather than your like Christian Vasquez, like down at the bottom of the order, like Jackie Bradley Jr. It's like, well, this is inevitable, this strikeout. And up come guys that you have little hope are really going to do anything. And Thayer writes, but Flynn preceded Casey, as did also Jimmy Blake, and the former was a Lulu, and the latter was a cake. So upon that stricken multitude, grim melancholy sat, for there seemed but little chance of Casey's getting to the bat. Like, well, way to support the home team, right? You're like practically walking out the stadium and like maybe looking back over your shoulder to see if something happens. And you have to realize too that being a Lulu was a prime insult back then. That was like being a classic bum. You were mired in an 0-for-22 slump if you were a Lulu. But what happens is these guys both come through. But Flynn let drive a single to the wonderment of all, and Blake, the much despised, to the cover off the ball. And when the dust had lifted and the men saw what had occurred, there was Jimmy safe at second and Flynn a hugging third. Now, that's kind of clever what he does there. He's not hugging third. He's a hugging third. Because it's like when you're excited about something, you kind of revert to that childish way of talking, almost like I'm a scared rather than scared. And it really taps into this like great sort of moment that you're going to get this pre-ESPN glorious walk-off occasion.
But no. And I have to say, too, one of the most inspired choices in the whole poem is the name of the hometown team, Mudville. My goodness, could you have a more perfect place than that?
It's very Dickensian by way of Mark Twain, almost, is how I think of it. And what's awesome, too, is when Casey comes up, he has a sense of the theatrical. You have to realize, too, that if you were someone who was reading this poem back then, you would have cared a lot about the theater. And we're not talking like Beckett, obviously, but the theater was your sort of playground. It was your Facebook, your movie house. It was what you would have had resonate with you. And like when you see something like in the Conan Doyle, the Sherlock Holmes story. You know how like Sherlock Holmes, he figures out the mystery. And you know how he always like kind of keeps it private until the end? He sets up something so he can basically have this epiphany moment where he reveals everything in front of Watson, and Watson's job is basically to shut his mouth and be like, all right, you ham, we've had enough of this, but you had your little theatrical flourish. So Casey comes up and the first pitch blows past him. He's like, nah, it's not my style. I'm not a man who likes to swing at the first pitch. I like to go behind in the count 0-1. It's like, you know, that's the crowd. So what they start doing is what like any crowd still does now is even when the call is the correct call, they're screaming for the umpire to be strung up. And it's just so hilarious to me. Then now he's like down in the count. He's not controlling the count. He has a bit of a problem going on. And the second pitch comes. And we're at strike two. But like now everyone's in an uproar. And Casey basically, he steps out of the batter's box. He has to calm everyone down. Like, hey, relax. I like to go yard on the third pitch. That's how we're doing this today. And then the funniest thing in the entire poem is he signaled to the pitcher.
Mm.
Like, you can go now. Like, who even thinks that way?
Well, yeah.
And, of course, it doesn't work out.
It's almost a precursor of Babe Ruth calling a shot.
Yeah. And I wonder, though, if one of the things when I was reading the poem again, I thought, you know what? I wonder if, like, Casey was at the end. Because Babe Ruth, yes, he called that shot, supposedly, against the Cubs. But remember Babe Ruth's like last three home runs? They come in the same game, right? When he's actually on a Boston team. Like the last three home runs Babe Ruth hit, it was all in one game. It wasn't his final game, but those were the final three. And I feel like Babe Ruth knew he was done. And when I read this poem, I wonder if like Casey almost knew he was done. That he wasn't so much overconfident as he knew that there was no way he was going yard. And he's kind of giving everyone a sort of moment. Maybe he's hoping to work the count and load the bases so some seeing eye single will bring in the necessary run. But he seems to me less like a man who's overconfident and more someone who's kind of unsure of his ability to succeed. And we sort of saw that with the NFL this weekend, right? When the fellow on the Bills goes in at halftime, and he's done. He's not coming out again. He can't compete at that level. And you get that sense here with Casey. So the crowd and the fans, they're not just sad that this game hasn't worked out, but it feels like there is something larger going forward that has come to an end.
And Thayer wraps it up so beautifully with an ending that I think is the absolute best part of the poem.
Right. Oh, somewhere in this favored land, the sun is shining bright. I like that idea because, like, it's gloomy here, but elsewhere, the rays are still upon us. The band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light. And somewhere men are laughing, somewhere children shout, but there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out. And he ends it so beautifully on that preposition, and it becomes more in that sort of concluding note, just a baseball thing. It goes beyond a baseball thing. It goes to having your hopes dashed and whatever that may be. And he doesn't give you anything else after that. He doesn't tarry. It's just everyone walk off the field, and that's going to be that. And you don't know, too. One of the things I like about this poem is, like, when you read a story, you kind of want, like, a definite timeline. You want to know that this started on Halloween and it went through April of the next year. You don't know when this ball game is being played, but the sort of timbre of the line makes it seem very autumnal.
Yes.
Like the last game of the season, the elimination game. And it wasn't like how it is now when the Red Sox, when they clinch the division tonight, they'll bring on the champagne and the goggles and everything. Like back then, if you watch like an old game, even something like the 1960 World Series, the Game 7, the Bill Mazeroski walk-off, like everyone just kind of leaves the field when it's all over. And that's how people would have left this particular ballpark in case he just would have gone back to doing some other job, you know, landscaping or whatever it might have been.
Yeah, and you get the impression, too, because it is Mudville and it's not a well-known city, that it's not a professional game, but that makes sense for 1888 when town teams were in many ways more popular than the pros were.
Right. Now, there's an episode of Little House on the Prairie, which you think of as, like, obviously kind of like this Lewis and Clark type show, right? People going west. Well, they're playing baseball, and baseball was absolutely gigantic in the 1800s, and baseball had been around for like a quarter of a century at this point, and you would have not had the DirecTV. You wouldn't have had the phone to give you the score updates. There wouldn't have really been a kind of national pastime in terms of national reach. It was a national pastime because of the local sort of market, that enclave that you would have been in. So if this Mudville, which might have been situated somewhere outside of Worcester, Massachusetts, this would have been the big social function, going down to the field behind somebody's farm to watch kind of these local legends who really weren't just local to you, because everything was local to you. So this was both kind of an interiority and an exteriority all at once.
Well, happy birthday today to Ernest Lawrence Thayer's Casey at the Bat, 130 years old. I have to ask you, too, before we let you go, Colin, I saw great news on social media that you're doing a lot of Orson Welles writing lately. I can't wait for that. And I wanted to ask you if you've seen, had a chance to see The Other Side of the Wind yet.
No, I haven't. I've just seen the trailer. I don't know what writing I'm going to be doing. Actually, there's some things that I'm waiting to hear back on, but it's definitely the season of Orson Welles. Between The Other Side of the Wind, you have the Criterion Blu-ray of The Magnificent Ambersons. The Indiana University had recently his, versions of his radio programs, and Better Than Ever Sound put up on their website, and lots of his writings. And he had said while he was alive, I'm sure you've heard this, they are going to love me when I'm dead. And I like seeing that this person who was the single most prescient artist I have ever encountered in my life. For the first half of my life, the Beatles were kind of like this end-all, be-all artistically. And I realized that Orson Welles as a mind, as a talent, as a genius, goes beyond even them. And he has a timelessness, and he'll always be around, and he will be kicking ass and taking names this fall, and I'm glad to see it.
I'm also very intrigued by the piece you're working on about the scariest radio program ever broadcast in America.
Yeah, you were one of the only people I thought that might have a good guess as to what that is.
And I don't.
Well, I mean, it's from 70 years ago, and are you familiar with the radio program Quiet Please?
Oh, yes.
So this would be the thing on the Forble board. And the Forble board is basically an oil derrick. So it's like four lengths of pipe down to the earth, but up in the air. And so a guy who's an oil rig worker is up on a so-called Forble board, and some not great stuff is coming out of the coring.
Now, was that Arch Obler? Was that one of his series?
No, that wasn't Obler, but it was like, it was basically some guys who had been affiliated with, speaking of Orson Welles, the Campbell House right, the Campbell Soup Playhouse and everything. So it's some carryover from that, and it was this program that was just on for a couple years, and it was funny because the most, like, some of the grisliest sound effects on all of radio, and it was on, like, midday for its first season. So, like, you'd come home from school, and you would turn on the radio rather than TV back in 1946, as it were, and you would get these very atmospheric radio programs, like as you were having your cookies and milk. It's quite strange with the sun outside, but yes, it was wonderful. And most of the recordings, all the 12, were thought lost. Now there are actually 88 that have been discovered and that are out there and that are downloadable. So that's one of the things I'm writing on tomorrow.
Well, I look forward to reading it. Colin Fleming, every Tuesday here on Downtown. Make sure you visit his website at colinflemminglit.com. Thanks, Colin.
All right. Thank you.